Hi, I'm Liam O'Rourke. I think Jamie Noble is the best thing on Raw. Larry the Cable Guy is no Arnold Schwarzenegger. And after browsing his last 48 hours of Twitter activity, I can confirm that Ryback is, in fact, dumb as fuck.
I'm G. John Chase, and right now I've been struggling whether to buy WWE 2K15 or not. I mean, I could sell Call of Duty, maybe I could get GTA 5. Guardians of the Galaxy's out as well now. Boy, I need a girlfriend.
And I'm Kieran O'Rourke. On Raw this week, AJ Lee told the Bella Twins that wrestling talent isn't sexually transmitted. Although true, coming from AJ, we can only assume that overinflated opinion in one's own ability is sexually transmitted.
This is the panel for the 21st Squared Circle Gazette Radio, and you can hear us talk about some of wrestling's greatest rivalries next. Hello everyone and welcome to the 21st Squared Circle Gazette Radio. I am Liam O'Rourke alongside G. John Chase.
Gazebo.
And Kieran O'Rourke.
Hi.
And I would like to apologise first and foremost for this podcast being on a 1 week delay. Basically, I'm not going to go into the details, but I spent 6 hours on the M1 last week when we were supposed to record this show, and I left the rest of my panel very, very unhappy. We're going to get to this today, hopefully. We are here, although we are absent. You know, Carl Jones, who's originally scheduled to be here, is not.
Disappointing, Carl.
Yeah.
Priorities, Carl. Priorities.
Now we got no beer.
Yeah, no, we got no beer without Carl here. But we're going to forge ahead anyway. We're here to talk about the all-time favourite feuds of us around the table. And, of course, you have provided ample feedback, the listeners, as usual. The whole idea of this is we're looking for commonalities, common threads, common themes for different favourite feuds, different legendary feuds in wrestling history. We're going to try and break them down a little bit. And after about 3 or 4 straight podcasts of cynicism, we're looking for some optimistic conversation today, at least until we get to the point where we start breaking down why these feuds weren't as good as people remember.
Yeah, let's just try and remember we are fans of wrestling.
We are, yeah, exactly. Yeah. This is supposed to be positive.
And this is people's opinions.
Yeah, exactly, which are always contradicting. We're going to start off with a big one here. Steve Austin versus Bret Hart. Pseudonymically from F4W, Bret Hart versus the US, a turning page in the quality of a then-declining WWF product. Awesome Bret Hart promos, awesome changing atmosphere between shows, awesome, awesome, awesome. Lockjaw from TPWW says, I'm not a huge Steve Austin fan, but Bret Hart and the Hart Foundation versus Steve Austin in the USA. As a kid, I just sympathised with Bret Hart, because almost everything he was saying about Austin was right, about how much of a poor role model he was, etc. But on the other hand, I had to admit Austin did have a certain badassness to him. That time he was in the ambulance and Attack Bret is one of my faves, and obviously WrestleMania 13 is one of my favourite moments of all time. The feud versus Bret is pretty much one of the only times I ever enjoyed Steve Austin. Civvy from the UK fan forum also voted for this, saying it's just pure hatred in classic matches. Andy Howard voted for the Hitman versus Steve Austin. Yeah, baby from the wrestling forum says, I don't think anything was done as well as Bret and Stone Cold. That's probably my all-time favourite. From the leading promos up to their first match, to the Rumble screwjob, to Bret's slow burn attitude change, to the greatest WrestleMania match of all time with the double turn, it was simple. Perfect. We're looking here for obviously the particular moments that make these feuds great and stand out, and this is one with many, many great moments.
Yeah, and more importantly, we can actually remember them and probably pick out most of them off the top of your head without doing much research, which I think in of its own right says a lot about a feud. Especially, we were just talking before we came on air, like feuds from the last 10, 15 years maybe, and the biggest problem, I think we've said so many times and time and time again, is feuds and turning points and stepping stones and angles don't resonate anymore because stuff's been overdone. Or, I mean, Austin Bret was simple, but it was pure, but it was beautiful. And the WrestleMania double turn really was a work of art. I think, you know, from the hard work they put in up until the actual execution and payoff themselves. I mean, that was.
I think it's fair to say that Austin Bret Hart is going to be in anybody's top five. Irrespective of what your favourite is of all time, I think that one's going to be in everyone's top five. Anyone who's ever seen it...
It should be,
It's got to be in their top five, surely. I mean, just the overall setup I thought was great. I mean, just taking apart that both characters are so polarising to each other. You know, just like, you know, Bret Hart being the absolute goody two-shoes and Austin just being the epitome of badassery, if you want to create a word like that. And, you know, just the whole storyline, you know, Bret loses a title, he goes away for a while. In the meantime, Austin's just running him down. Whole, like, you put the letter S in front of Hitman, that's my opinion of Bret Hart.
That segment, I think it's from Mind Games, where it's him, yeah. Owen Hart and Brian Pillman just taking turns burying Bret Hart.
Yeah. It's just like, you know, the Survivor Series match being really good, and even though they redid the end sequence of WrestleMania 8, with the whole, like, he's got the...
the Roddy Piper finish.
Yeah, the Roddy Piper finish, where he's got the, was it, $1 million dream on him, and he rolls over onto him. I thought it was a great match. I thought that really was that. I thought that was really was the beginning. I know everyone always comments on King of the Ring 96 as the beginning for Austin. I think in terms of definitely his character and getting noticed from the mediocrity that was happening in that company, that was certainly a standing point. But for me, it was Survivor Series 96 and that match with Bret Hart where it really comes across like, okay, this guy isn't just intercontinental. This guy is going to be like huge. And obviously, you know, a lot of credit goes to Bret. Bret's that is that good, but Austin is as well, and that's why they were a great juxtaposition between each other, if that's the right word.
Yeah, yeah.
I was going to say that. Who just off the top of my head, who gained the most from the feud? I mean, probably off the top of my head, initially say Steve because you know Bret brought him up to his level. I think what else would Bret be doing?
This is the thing, I was actually going to mention this, because the reason why, one of the reasons why this is amongst my favourite feuds of all time is Raw in 1996 is such a bland morass of television. I love Shawn Michaels more than 99% of the wrestling population. Kieran, you can attest to this, you might be in the other 1%. But I think that WWF TV at the time was slow, it was struggling, it was having a hard time catching up to Nitro in terms of how dynamic it was. The most all-encompassing angle in the company from when Bret returned was Bret and Steve, and it carried on obviously into WrestleMania 13 and even afterwards. It dominated television until the end of the summer.
I just think maybe the Austin intensity was something probably Bret hasn't had a lot to work with as he'd want over the years, and it brought an extra dimension out of Bret that after so many years in that company he'd done everything at that point really. Great chemistry, perfect pro wrestling.
Yeah, it is. That's the thing, perfect pro wrestling. When he came back, it was just like, it was great because he clearly came back with something to prove. And Austin also had everything to prove because even though, you know, he won King of the Ring, he wasn't even on SummerSlam, he was in the pre-show with Yoko. Yeah. So that tells you what high expectations there were for Steve Austin coming out of King of the Ring. It was the feud with Bret, and Bret handpicked him to do the feud. And just everything about it after that WrestleMania 13, there's an awesome episode of Raw, one of my favourite episodes of Raw of all time. I think it's April 21st. It's one where they do the street fight with Bret and Austin. And then obviously Bret's in the ambulance, Austin pulls him out, beats the shit out of him in the ambulance, and then in the end Pillman returns and the New Heart Foundation's taking shape. It's just great TV.
That's the great thing, because when looking at these feuds and like, okay, we've already said we're not judging anyone by their personal opinions, but when you're looking about what a great feud is, there has to be several high points on there, and that's what we've been doing so far. We've been saying the several high points, you know, the initial run, Survivor Series 96, WrestleMania is obviously probably the height of that feud, you know, because just what they achieved, and it also being one of the greatest WrestleMania matches as well. Also going all the way through to a Canadian Stampede, which we commented on before, where, okay, even though there was a lot more people involved in that match, it was essentially Bret versus Austin again with the countries on their side, and it's just, you know, an absolutely electrifying main event.
Yeah, that Canadian Stampede in general, I mean, it's something I think we've always wanted them to kind of duplicate, and it's always something
they kind of came close to Punk in Chicago.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's, you know, comes from xenophobia in wrestling anyway, so it's not exactly a new thing, but I mean, it was done so perfectly, the USA, and it was organic.
The sheer luck of doing Raw in one country to the next, to the next, you know, for a few straight shows really helped.
This feud is held so highly by the two people in it as well.
Oh, yeah.
You know, when any time Bret Hart and Austin, you know, ask questions about the feud, you know, they don't shy away from it. You know, Austin said it's one of his favourite feuds, it's not his favourite, and same with Bret Hart as well, you know. And it's
Bret openly says that's his favourite time of his career.
Because they just both know how well they connected with one another, and I think that's a big testament to both of them and the feud.
Interesting little dynamic here as well, that I've always thought was really kind of a cool touch, that Austin never pinned Bret.
With the performances and the angles that they were going with, and the momentum he had, would wins have helped?
No, in the execution, no, probably not, because I think by protecting Bret, it kind of maybe kept Austin honest with the crowd, maybe. It didn't feel like he was getting the Uber push, probably because he wasn't at the time.
Yeah.
It maybe helped keep him a little honest with the crowd. It's something I was thinking, obviously, over the last year with the ascension of Roman Reigns as apparent heir apparent. Yeah, they've given him a couple of losses here and there, and when the crowd started to turn on him a little bit. So I think it's something that maybe goes not mentioned too much, but yeah, there's a certain degree to keeping him honest, which helps in the long run. And it's good to remember as well, the positions the two guys were in, it was Austin coming up to his level, so
yeah.
they were kind of retaining Brett's authenticity without, you know, without jobbing him out to create a star, but it didn't hurt Austin because of the type of the way he was getting over and his character. Just talking about these, after this podcast all about feuds, we've had so much feedback. I mean, we said we were looking for like themes and kind of commonalities between.
Yeah.
I think what this straight away, elements that make up a good feud, great matches, this feud had it.
Great promos too.
Great promos with engaging personalities. With engaging personalities. And those iconic moments. I think really this is the feud adds, as from a fan's point of view, an enjoyment point of view, had everything. So
yeah, we're going to segue here. Tiger Rick from UK Fan Forum says, would have to go with Austin Barrett. Alessa mentioned one that I love so much that I made a DVD compilation a few years ago, is Savage versus Page, easily the best feud WCW ever booked. Interesting candidate here.
Let me go to Mr. Chase.
Yes, yes.
Two men you love with a passion.
Yeah, I mean... Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, for completely different reasons as well. I mean, and I think probably one of the reasons why I like Paige was because of the Savage feud, you know, when I've watched it back anyway.
Again, very topical in terms of elevation.
Absolutely. I mean, I would actually state probably why I would link this feud. I'll link this to another one, but we won't go into this other feud yet. But I would link this one as very similar to Mick Foley, Randy Orton in 2004. As in, the same with Mick Foley, I think this was his last shot at a really good feud. Like he had tapered off a little bit in terms of the quality of his matches by this point in the mid to late 90s, and I think this was his last shot. I think he saw something in Page, and he was right, that this guy he could do something with him. He could see that, I don't know, maybe Page's mentality backstage also played a hand in it. You know, he saw that this guy really wanted it.
Yeah, it was great. There's the great scene, I think it was Uncensored, where they did the original angle where Savage spray paints Kimberly in the kind of pseudo "I raped your wife" kind of an angle that Bill Watts would do back in the day. And then it led to obviously the great match at Spring Stampede, where DDP gets the first win, and obviously they go back and forth. But as you know, in terms of, like, again, just the Steve Austin commonality of where they were before and where they were afterwards, DDP was in a hell of a position, not quite the position that Austin was in, but again, it's just an interesting dynamic in the sense of it really rejuvenated Savage. Again, to the Bret Hart point, it did as much, in my opinion, for Savage, because Savage got to headline a couple of pay-per-views based off this feud.
Mm. I think what's shocking about this, it was, you know, coming out of the malaise of WCW and no one giving a shit and taking the paycheck, and I think...
Yeah,
probably we'd probably typecast Savage into that role at that point as well. So it was a real boon that this camp kind of came out of nowhere. And...
All right, we're going to segue back over to the WWF for Hulk Hogan versus Andre the Giant. Slicky Tricky Damon from TPWW says, easily, it's Hogan versus Andre. It was the feud that launched the advancement of the WWF. It's not just about WrestleMania 3. It's not about the most important part of the deal. There was 93,000 people came... 78,000 people came to Pontiac, Michigan in the Silver Dome to see them fight. The feud launched the rest of the big three pay-per-views, and WrestleMania was a mainstay for the company. In November 1987, Survivor Series was created, and it was the first time Hogan and Andre were in a match against one another since WrestleMania 3. One of the main drawing points of the first Rumble special was a contract signing for Hogan and Andre. Hulk and Andre got the first round bye and fought each other to a double DQ. That led to Hogan and Andre's feud being linked to DiBiase and Macho Man to launch SummerSlam. The feud launched the grand unveiling of WrestleMania on national pay-per-view, launched the Survivor Series in SummerSlam. The one-off shooting of the feud also led to the destruction of the Mega Powers and the main event of WrestleMania 5. A great feud doesn't live in a vacuum. If the feud begins and ends with just the people involved, then it's a failure. Bit of a broad statement there. Hulk and Andre is one of the most influential feuds in the history of sports entertainment. There could only be one other feud really in this discussion, McMahon and Austin. This feud launched so many other feuds that it was at the time where wrestling was already established on national television. The fact that Hogan and Andre launched the Big Four makes it more important to me.
I'll be honest with you, for very, very much a long time when it came to this feud, I was mystified as to why it's been held in such high regard. And then I actually more recently sat back and watched WrestleMania 3 again, and I watched it with yourself, Liam. I mean, the build is fantastic, you know.
The build's awesome. The build to me is the charm of the feud, because the matches are nothing, but the build up with the Piper's Pits especially deserves some praise, because Piper was awesome. Yeah. That scene where fucking Andre rips the shirt and the crucifix off. There's a little bit of blood and the cross is on the ground. The camera zooms on it. Fuck me, it was great. Jesse Ventura's there just being a cock and, you know, rubbing salt in the wound for Hogan. Ah, it's marvellous.
It's great because, I mean, right at that time, you know, he, you know, Andre had been a babyface for an incredibly long time. Yeah. And so this was just something completely new. Again, like that old chestnut that we've been going on about this podcast so far, rejuvenating a guy, turning heel, being put with Bobby the Brain Heenan, which is obviously going to work.
Oh, Heenan was fucking marvellous.
And also, you know, you mentioned Jess Ventura is obviously always fantastic. And Roddy Piper during those segments as well.
Yeah, Piper was
key. Was really kind of like, very took a low key. For Piper,
that's why
his start, and he was fantastic.
The
as
fact
well.
That he's low key and kind of not necessarily on Hogan's side, but after their blood feud from you know, a couple of years before, he's like he's the one that says to Hogan, "Hulk, you're bleeding." You know, it's like with the cross and stuff. It's like this is just great, Bobby. You mentioned Bobby Heenan there; he deserves a mention just because of his fantastic press conference he did for WrestleMania 3, where Gene Oakland asked him, "How can Andre do this?" Hulk Hogan looked up to him, and Heenan goes, "Well, it's because he's 7'5".
Yeah. Oh yes, that's a great one. He just fucking smashes it, doesn't he? He's just the funniest guy ever. How is he the bad guy?
Walks out with the suit and the glasses onto this press conference. Like, look at this fucking guy. But yeah, to the detouring, obviously. Yeah. Interesting point in terms of how they did use Hogan and Andre to anchor big shows, especially trying to kick him off the ground. SummerSlam 88, there was very, I don't want to say there's very little juice, but to me DiBiase was hotter then than Andre was. That felt like going to the well one last time.
By that point that was a transition. I mean, they already got the big buy rate for WrestleMania 3, and they'd also had the big figures for Saturday Night main event. So those were the two key ones, you know, the main match and the rematch. By that point,
33 million viewers.
By that point, they're obviously trying to just, through osmosis, try and rub that off onto DiBiase.
The question we've got to ask, obviously, though, with Hogan and Andre is how much of it is now nostalgia and myth, and how much of it is legitimate and deserved carries over from the time itself? That was, as you said, that was the tail end of Andre's career, but so many people would think of it as almost, was it the pinnacle, or was it...
Andre, I mean,
business wise, obviously, but
yeah, in terms of
he must have got the most money.
The first
career in that moment,
the first $1 million gate close, in wrestling history, closed circuit records, pay per view buy rate was fucking through the roof for that show. It's interesting because Andre, you can always point to the fact that Andre drew like 10,000 seat sellouts at stadiums all over the country for years and years and years as the perennial babyface. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting that the tail end of his career is what people remember of Andre.
It's because because he'd been protected so much up to that point, and
the classic irresistible force and movable object.
Yeah, I mean, he'd actually cultivated a myth about himself before that point. That's kind of the thing I was kind of alluding to.
Whether it really deserves its right for, I don't know if I'd go so far as the feedback there is to say this was what launched the WWF as we know it today, because WrestleMania did that, the original one with Piper. Mm. Andre and Hogan was big to the wrestling fans, and it wasn't as big to the mainstream. Mm. The audience was already in place by the time Hogan and Andre was there. And it was in place because of Piper and Hogan. So I think that, I don't know whether to say necessarily burn out proportion, I think that it's perfect in the proportion that it has, and that it was the wrestling fans' dream match. Coffee from Pro Wrestling Only also voted for this. He said, former friends Andre, who is seemingly unbeatable and never had a desire for the championship before it was corrupted by Bobby the Brain Heenan, turns on his friend and wants the belt. Hogan is the top dog babyface during an incredible run, doesn't want to fight his friend at first. The crucifix is ripped off. Hogan agrees to the match. WrestleMania 3, biggest house ever. Hogan manages to not only win but slam the unbeatable giant to retain the title. There's controversy regarding an early pinfall attempt which gives WWF another year's worth of material to build to WrestleMania 4, where a tournament is held for the title and both men get a first round by. The match itself at Mania 3 wasn't full of good work, but man, the emotion and the atmosphere was great. The build-up and story was great. It was the two biggest guys colliding at the biggest show over the biggest prize. Like I said, that definitive element, I think, is really what helps establish this. Yeah. Moving on to something a little different from a little bit earlier on. Steve Pachenik, my pick for the best feud ever is Magnum TA and Tully Blanchard. They told a fabulous story during the feud with Tully winning the title from Magnum with an object, and Magnum's intent on getting his title back. The culmination I Quit match at Starrcade was so brutal that it set the standard for how feuds should end. But the violence wasn't the story, and the US title has become an afterthought. The true reason why this one was so special was the hatred these men displayed towards each other, and the reason why it hasn't been duplicated since.
Tully Blanchard, first off, is just sensational.
Tully Blanchard is one of my favourite heels of all time.
He's just great. I mean, when Shawn Michaels turns around, like on the DVD, the Four Horsemen DVD, and turns around and says, like, Tully Blanchard was the first cool heel ever, and he just and then you're watching him, and even though, like, by today's standards it looks cheesy, you're just thinking, that's a cool motherfucker.
No,
there.
It's not. It's great. To me, Tully holds up. He's like Bond.
Baby doll. Oh, she had a bit of cleavage today, baby doll. You know, it's just like, he was just great with, like, the hair and everything, and just the fact, like, you know, he was a small guy as well. He was he was a small guy for that time period.
Yeah, but at the same time, size wasn't as big an issue then, especially in the NWA.
But it didn't. But also, like, he didn't really show it.
See, I'm not sure. I've never been sure about Magnum. As in, is this guy cool?
But what about that Mid South video they made to "Sweet Dreams" by Eurythmics, where he's just fucking macking on all the women at the pub?
It's a good point, actually. Yeah. but it's in terms of wonderful chemistry between the two characters.
Yeah, it's like awesome.
The slimiest. Chipbird Tully and this especially rugged man's man. I think Tully helped the rugged man's man stuff because Tully was so fucking fantastic himself.
Yeah.
As the shit bird. But yeah, I said just wonderful chemistry. In terms of Magnum, I'm not sure because so much you said about Magnum in terms of like the potential and stuff. Yeah. And I'm not too sure.
The thing with this feud, just to get away from the Magnum and Tully talk individually speaking, the reason I love this, first of all, the angle where Magnum kisses Baby Doll and Tully Blanchard comes out in his suit and just fucking wrecks Magnum from behind and his brawl on the studio floor is awesome. And just to Steve's point about the pure hatred, it is absolutely exemplified in that angle. There's a few others where you know, Magnum and Tully are brawling after a Tully match. And the match at Starrcade, the I Quit match, is one of the more legendary matches in Starrcade history. I love the closing scene of that match where Tully's just gushing blood. He's pissing blood out of his head. Selling his eye, he's just been stabbed with one thing. And Magnum, who's victorious and has got his belt back, has his fist cocked, is grabbing Tully by the hair and pulling his head up as Tully's kind of on his back. And he just looks at him and decides to win the war and he just lets his head go.
Yeah.
And it's like, that is so brilliant. It's just that definitive, the fight is over, the good guy wins, that the heel gets exactly what he deserves. And I think that probably goes some way into people remembering that fondness of it was pure hatred and the right thing happened. It was no missteps.
You don't get that sort of detail anymore in feuds.
Talking about a culmination as well, it's something it's hard to differentiate these days when everything just blends into everything else.
But they don't want to give a culmination now because they want to fucking. They're thinking about Raw tomorrow, so they don't care about.
Yeah, we've got another three shows this week. So
we've got to go again, boys.
We've
got like 6 more hours to fill, so we don't want to. Let's have the ref take.
Yeah, but I mean, the point being, a clear, concise narrative is, you know, it's. I don't think we should really have to explain. That should be a prerequisite for a feud. But I think in this day and age, maybe we do. But clear, concise structure of the story goes a long way, I think. So.
It does indeed. We are moving forward a little bit timeline-wise. As Aaron, 1985, from F4W Online, says, Randy Savage versus Jake Roberts. Maybe it was because I was quite young at the time, but it seemed so, so real.
Yes. Oh, boy. I love this feud. I, funny enough, I don't actually remember this feud at the time. Really? I don't know whether it was due to its briefness. I'm not certain, but... I couldn't have saw it.
That's the big, for me, iconic, what we were talking about before, you know, standout iconic moments...
This the snake bite.
Yeah.
If you saw this, you'd remember.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, exactly. So I'm guessing, and also, if I was a Savage fan, I probably would have hated Snake for the rest of my life, but I don't. I love him as well.
He crashed the wedding. Come on.
Oh, yeah. Well, of course. He crashes the wedding with Undertaker in tow, wasn't he? With Undertaker
they were a heel duo for a while. Yeah. Very brief period in 91.
Yeah. But they crashed the wedding first, and he goads him, gets him into the ring, and he attacks him with the snake, which straight away, like, in the audience, they knew something was up with this snake as soon as he pulled it out, because it wasn't like the usual quite placid snake that he has, but it's just kind of just slithering around. This one was, to use a word, erect, and was ready to go, right? It was just ready to pounce.
And technical snake turn.
I think it is. And, you know, and the snake actually bites him, which you can actually kind of see if you notice close enough. The snake's having problems taking the snake off because it's properly in.
I thought he was trying to draw blood. The way he's holding the head and he's wriggling it, it's almost like he's trying to draw blood, because then you get a bit of blood.
And then I think you see
like a press on underneath the chin and eventually gets it off. But.
And, you know, just Macho Man with the venom coursing through him, you know, and he's trying to punch Jake, and Jake's just laughing his ass off, and like they finally manage to drag Macho Man away.
Falls off the stretcher,
which is just so Macho Man. And Jake is just there looking at the snake.
I love
they're having a conversation.
The two scenes that I absolutely love is the one where Jake, when they're taking Savage off, all the chaos going outside, Jake's in the corner and the snake is just in front of him, arched up, looking at the aisle, he's completely like just protecting
it's so
Jake.
In tune.
And that final and that great scene when like Jake's just looking at the snake, who's looking back at him, laughing like they're talking in snake talk.
And it was just Jake's promos during that time as well, with Mean Gene as well. A lot of credit to Mean Gene because he was just great as a great sidekick to Jake during those promos. And he does the most dastardly thing. of slapping Miss Elizabeth across the face, which at the time was shocking. Little do we know,
like, a woman.
Little do we know, years later in 2000, people were cheering the Dudley Boys powerbombing a 92-year-old woman through a table. Right, this is a completely different time.
Times change.
Yeah, where something like slapping a woman as precious as Miss Elizabeth was absolutely atrocious.
That's the word. That's beautiful. Precious.
Yeah. And it was just that promo, which I will go on a limb. I'm sure I'll probably think of something later down the line. I'll probably say this might be my favourite promo of all time.
It's fine.
With Jake the Snake
Roberts. Say favourite. There's no accountability.
He comes to the back, and me and Jesus saying, you know, what the hell was
Get
that?
Get the hell out of here!
What the hell? You're a monster. You sick. You know, you're a sick freak. You know, and I would have paid for that. I would have paid to slap your wife again. You
he
know,
basically no, says beat, it's better beat, than an orgasm. Is what?
Yeah,
he's
yeah. He goes, you know, beating Macho Man is one thing, but like slapping his wife was another thing. He goes, I'd pay to do that. You know, and he can. Just the elements of the promos are so fantastic, and he just kind of ends it with, you know, like, just do me one favour, Macho Man. If you're coming after me, just do me one favour, bring her with you, okay? Let me just touch her one more time. Like, trust me.
Yeah.
Trust me. And you just watch that, and you just go, like,
what a cock.
If you're doing a class on how to be a heel, he's just masterclassed you on how to be a fucking heel. There's nothing likable about him.
That's the thing. What's so brilliant about this feud is the dynamic between the three characters. You got, obviously, the retired legend in Randy, you know, beloved former hero, the perfect princess in Miss Elizabeth, and the absolute dirtiest motherfucker in the world.
And like, Jake would, so good.
Yeah, he would. Everyone's thinking Jake would probably fucking rape Elizabeth if it was off camera.
Yeah.
But he's like, this guy's a dirty motherfucker. He's like, dirty, just. Jake is best.
That's why Jake is held in such high regard. I mean, he was a great babyface, but here as a heel, like, it's just, you know, it's so refreshing when watching it back in comparison to what we get today, where every heel feels like they need to be cool in some way. Like, they go, like, okay, I want you to boo me, but I kind of want you to like me as well. Whilst Jake was just so great in the fact he knows, I want you to hate me. I want you to try and piss on my car outside afterwards. I want you to despise me. I want you to think that, you know, I'm someone that could rape Miss Elizabeth, you know. And he just did it absolutely to perfection.
Yeah, I agree, but different times, because you're telling me Jake wouldn't get cheered after a month today.
Well, exactly. Yeah, I guess so. It is different times.
The thing that always kind of baffled me, and of course after the fact reading about this retrospectively, this didn't draw at all, this feud. That's one of those things, it's like one of life's great mysteries. Like, look how great this feud is. How can you not want to see Jake get killed by Savage? It didn't draw well in the house shows at all. It's one of those things. I don't know if it was just because the business was kind of falling quite rapidly at the time, because of the whole steroid stuff.
Because when obviously Savage took around a couple more years, but when Savage ends up leaving because Vince didn't want to use him as talent anymore, was this a factor in that, maybe, that thinking that his drawing power had gone? He had his retirement previously, came back with Jake, didn't draw,
and then when they gave him the belt off Flair at WrestleMania, he again as champion didn't draw very well at all. Moving to more modern day, Steve Austin versus The Rock, of course, gets plenty of nominations. Smelly Meatball from TPWW says, always liked how that feud started off in the mid card and then built up to the point that once both guys were main eventers, the bad blood between the two was well established, developed naturally as a mega feud, not something constantly force fed to the audience to accept like an Orton and a Cena. Shane Mac version 2 from the UK fan forum says, Rock and Austin for me. I didn't see much of the original feud in 99, but I love how both guys are on the rise at the same time. From iconic moments like throwing the IC title into the water to the main event of WrestleMania 15, it was good quality, and both guys were kept apart from a single feud while they both skyrocketed in popularity. By the time WrestleMania 17 rolled around, the amazing sit-down interview with JR, the subsequent match at the pay-per-view was a work of art, so violent and flawlessly executed. I don't know about that. The finish was highly suspect.
Yeah.
Although the match itself was very, very good.
The Deborah involvement in that.
Yeah, I didn't like that too much either. He then goes on to talk about how, you know, the final chapter of the feud of WrestleMania with Austin being retired and stuff. The contrast between them made the Attitude Era, in my opinion. DX was an important part of it all, so was The Undertaker and plenty of others, but these two stood out above the rest, and without each other, I don't think either could have become as big as they did. Maybe not Rock, but Austin was already there.
For me, that whole feud was different to this. These two guys don't particularly like each other for whatever reason. For me, watching it always came across as these two guys know that they're the best. They know that in any other time period, they'll just be on their own. They'll just be them, and they'll be the hot top dog, but because of some freak of nature, we now have two top dogs in the company, and which one's the best? And you can see it in both their eyes that they want to be the top dog, and that's where it came from. It didn't come from like a storyline nature, though they had that in there as well. I think it came from a personal nature of they were competing to see who was the best.
I'm not sure if I would include, obviously you would do, but the first half of the feud, when Rock's on the rise and it's over the IC title, it really, he was Austin's bitch at that point.
Oh, it totally was. He was just a vehicle to help Austin.
Never, yeah. Austin, you know, Austin didn't lose to him, didn't drop the title to him, did he? I think it was forfeit, nope. I think. So, yeah.
He never lost to him until the end.
Yeah, he never lost him before. So, yeah. I don't know, it's a weird one because Rock was always subservient to him.
He totally was.
Up until, was it probably 99, 2000 when Austin was out of the picture for a while? And, yeah. Okay, well, now it's Rocky's turn, but he was always subservient to Austin. So, I got weird feelings about this one, to be honest.
Yeah, in terms of an all time favourite feud, they're a great. I think it's one of these things where, because it was two top guys. Actually, there's a bit of feedback here I'll read, because actually I think this goes into why people are quite fond about this. TRMD from Pro Wrestling Only says, Austin and Rock, two guys that check literally every box that you want in a pro wrestler. The hatred felt real, the respect felt real, they both carried an unbelievable aura, their personalities were so different, yet their chemistry was undeniable. The promos, the stare downs, the brawls, the pops, the catchphrases, it was Brady Manning, it was bird magic, it was gold. That element there, the two top guys, like you mentioned, G, I think that's a lot of why people remember this, because there are moments that people remember and love about this feud. Obviously, you know, the beer bath gets replayed all the damn time. The funeral that the Rock does for Austin is just hilarious. Yeah, dearly. Trailer park trash. Yeah. Just there were many, many great moments.
And as you mentioned, the sit down interview with Jim Ross as well on lead up to 17.
Yeah. But although it didn't actually get over live at all, the fans in the arena were like launching popcorn and stuff at the screen because it was going so long they hated it.
Oh, the idiots.
But again, to that point, I love the sit down interview and it looks great in the music videos. Yeah. Like you mentioned the Deborah stuff. That really kind of I hated that.
She was Rock's manager.
She was Rock's manager by order of Vince to fuck with Austin.
Yeah, horrible. That's just trying to add a wrinkle to a story that didn't need it.
At the end of 2000, they did like these little kind of cross pollinations with Austin and Rock, and the crowd would always be so live. And I remember just thinking, man, if they do that match again, this is going to be fucking great.
Just for me personally. I think both of those guys had better feuds away from each other. I think Rock had better feuds with other people. I think Austin had better feuds with other people.
I think that's Austin obviously had a more important feud with Vince
which was a lot more about them being, you know, with Rock and his individual feuds, and Austin with his, was about, you know, their best feuds with someone that was complete opposite to them. We've already mentioned, you know, Austin with Bret Hart. I would also throw in there Rock with Mankind as well, being one.
We'll get to that.
Yeah, where, you know, just two people completely polar opposites.
I probably agree that in terms of like a narrative story, those two, they've got better work, bodies of work elsewhere. It's just, I think people will pick this out because it was the two big boys probably at their peak, in wrestling's peak. It's always going to be mentioned, so just like Hogan Andre. X7, it was awesome in so many respects, but as you say, the if you take that as the culmination, would you take that as a culmination of the feud? Irrelevant. But the damage Quinn out of it is with Austin.
Sours it somewhat.
It sours it massively.
I also think, like, depending on which fan you are, I think also depends on how you see the feud as well. I think if you're an Austin fan, and obviously the first two matches are much more key. For me, myself, being the Rock mark, but I prefer the third one. I know a lot of people think that's probably the weakest or maybe the second best, but I thought, you know, Austin was good enough at that time. You know, it was like his last performance. The Rock was just sensational in early 2003, you know, just like he's just going all out, just having fun, basically, you know, putting it on Austin's, you know, vest and just mocking him and so on, just fucking
doing.
Around, just having fun, and you know, he gets that win, which is what I was waiting for. That's what chapped my ass for so many years, is the fact that Austin kicked the Rock's ass twice.
Not the obviously the IC title part of the feud, but the first part of the feud over the world title, I see, so around 15. Rock is really a function of the Austin McMahon feud as well, rather than being those two
handpicked champions.
So yeah, so he was still a function of the McMahon feud rather than him himself. So I think that's something, maybe that's what probably marks it down a little bit. So
yeah, 19 was one too many. I think the dynamic wasn't the same with those two. Even if it's your personal favorite, that the feud build up, it didn't feel like
it's irrelevant to me.
Yeah, it was irrelevant to me. It was irrelevant to me too, because it just felt like this was dated. Yeah. And you know, back then wrestling did move so damn quick. So we could say that now.
I mean, it wasn't the main event, was it?
Moving back here to a previous one from years past, Cactus Chuck from F4W Online. Kevin Sullivan versus Blackjack Mulligan. Lock me in as a fan for life. We've been watching the Kevin Sullivan in Florida tapes very, very recently. So I'm actually keen to see what you think on this one, Kim, because we mentioned Kevin Sullivan in the top 50 heels in the WWE.com's illustrious opinion. And I kind of mentioned that, you know, I'd seen Kevin Sullivan's Florida stuff, and I personally didn't think it held up well over time, which obviously isn't really necessarily fair to say, because that's not what this person's grading on. But the Kevin Sullivan character is the kind of... I always thought this feud was quite funny, because Mulligan just fucking dwarfs him in the matches.
He's a huge bitch.
He's a huge dude.
Yeah, I must admit, I didn't watch all of it all through, and quite frankly, Kendall Windham turned me off.
Yeah, guys like Mike... Yeah, okay, because this feud obviously doesn't just involve... I think that's actually quite key to note. It involves, you know, Maya Singh and Purple Haze, and it also involves Kendall Windham and Mike Graham and Billy Graham as they start getting further down the road. The addition of these guys really kind of sours me, because it's so much better when it's focused on Sullivan and Mulligan.
I wasn't blown away with Sullivan, to say the least. I feel a little unfair saying that, but my initial impression was...
Always context at the time.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Initial impressions was... He didn't come across like a big league player to me. However relevant that is.
Yeah, I mean, when you watch the videos, he's clearly over to a great degree to the fans live there at the time, and obviously he drew big money. So I mean, what can you know? And the feud with Dusty Rhodes, you know, following the Mulligan one as well, he drew a lot of money and he was very, very successful. But again, just from an artistic perspective, well, I didn't watch it at the time. None of us did. I just can't get into the Kevin Sullivan. It just seems so... He's from Boston.
Yeah.
You know?
A bit contrived, that's it. I wanted to give him the benefit of the doubt because of all the love he gets, but this little Boston midget. with his little side parting because he's got hair at the time, I just was a little unsure. I need to see more, I think.
He does look like quite the kind of a devilish little fucker. Like, he does have a good look to
him.
I just wanted
to pinch his cheek and send him on his way. You little scamp, you.
He was very dastardly at the time. There's a lot of great angles with, you know, the spike and stuff like that.
I freely admit I need to see more. But, just first impression, so.
The Real Deal 2414 from F4W mentions... Jerry Lawler versus Andy Kaufman. Yeah. Green Lawler from Wrestling Forum also says, Kaufman versus Lawler, the slow build and intricate swerve has never been duplicated. The level of how well Lawler and Andy fooled the fans and even the rest of the boys is unimaginable today. Kaufman infuriated the CWA fans on par with only Jimmy Hart, and that 1 year or so stretch was white hot for the area. It brought a level of publicity never before seen, been written off by most of the wrestling world because of Nick Gulas's bad payouts. This feud... must be discussed.
I think just before you go into large monologues, I'll let you go off with this. I think this has got to be one of the few occasions where celebrity involvement was done right.
There's a few of them.
There's a few of them, but this is up there.
I fucking love Andy Kaufman.
He's so great.
He is my... If I could be anyone, if I could be like influenced on the wrestling industry for a brief period of time with one angle, I'd be Andy Kaufman doing his gift. He's just... It's hard to quantify really now, because with this Kaufman had the myth behind Kaufman, what, you know, when's he working, when's it fake, and they tied that into it as well, because, you know, they freely admitted he's this rich guy, he wants to play a wrestler, and when he's doing the stuff with the women at the start, and that's fantastic as well.
Intergender champion.
It's none of these like a bullshit match with a woman. It was just a grapple that went a three minute time limit, throwing each other to the floor and just trying to roll around on top of this woman. It's absolutely fantastic. Just it seems genuine. This skinny, obnoxious
wannabe,
who,
big shot from Hollywood.
Yeah,
from Hollywood.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing. When the two elements of this feud, the feud kind of in Memphis, in Memphis, Tennessee, plow the fields and farm, your Memphis Hicks doing his little monkey dance. Oh my god, absolute genius! But it's not just a guy taking a piss, you know, because he isn't like a wrestler. But they get a convincing, believable story with the hero Jerry Lawler against his absolute pissant. It's unbelievable brilliance. It's like, and just the way, again, I don't know how, what was written, planned in. My impression is they had the bullet points where they're going, and Kaufman just went and did what he wanted to get to that point. And he's, you know, they talk about guy don't do promos these days. This guy, not a wrestler, he's obviously a live performer, that's where his talent is. But he's concise, but he's clever, he's creative, he takes it over different directions, but then brings it back to his key points. Oh man, it's absolute joy to watch Andy Kaufman just do this thing.
In this element.
Yeah, and the myth around it all, of the Andy Kaufman myth of what was real and what's fake, it's just extra element to it. The mystique behind Kaufman is just... And Lawler himself...
I was going to say, you've got to mention Lawler here, because Lawler's one of my all-time favourites, but man, he was just fucking, again, in his element here.
It's like he's... Yeah, I mean, again, first of all, what's great about this feud is... how he's presented by like Lance Russell, unbelievable.
Lance Russell is God.
God,
by the way.
God damn, Lance Russell's fantastic. Mr. Russell. Yeah. They don't let on that Kaufman's going to kick his ass. The only person who says that Kaufman's going to kick someone's ass is Kaufman. And he's Kaufman.
Everyone's saying, you're going to get hurt. Yeah, you're going to get hurt, son. And he's, I think Lawler says that.
And Kaufman, it's like he's this maniacal, crazy, lost his mind. You believe he's actually... Yeah, he might actually be a rich guy just doing whatever the fuck he wants, because that's what's happening.
Yeah.
But and then these times he'll just absolutely lose his shit and go berserk. Like when they're doing the phone call interview, yeah. He's absolutely lose his shit. It's, oh my God, this guy's an absolute genius. I love this so much, and it makes sense. You know where you are as you're going through the feud. It's logical when the beat's back and forth. It's, you know where you are, like who's got the upper hand over who at that point in time. It's absolutely makes sense.
It gets a lot of people talk, just to cut you off here, because you're on a bit of a roll. I love what you're saying, because it's like a lot of people always talk about how, you know, eventually, obviously, diminishing returns, it didn't draw as well as it did initially, because obviously the repetition of Andy. But I love it, man. I love the fact that they were able to keep it going for a good while and get some massive play out of this thing.
It's like the everyone talks about the power driver match. When he,
the first in the mid-South Carolina scene.
Yeah, when he took it, I think he took two, and
took
then he
kind
of did he take upon himself just to stay there.
He didn't want to move, he didn't want to leave the ring, so he told the ref to tell Lawler, get an ambulance, can we get an ambulance? And Lawler said, sends the word back, no, it costs money. And then Andy Kaufman sends the word back, I'll pay. So they get the ambulance.
So that starts the bounty, doesn't it?
And that leads to Letterman.
And that's, oh yeah, obviously Letterman.
You've got to mention that, because that's the thing most people will know about. So
That was awesome as well. It's like Kaufman, absolute genius. They've taken this feud from Memphis, where it's in this confined, localized spot where it's within, you know, the realms.
Within their own little bubble.
Yeah, within the bubble of Memphis wrestling. They go to, I guess it's New York on Letterman, and this crowd...
It's weird, isn't it?
The live audience, it's obvious. I don't think they're too familiar, most of them, who Jerry Lawler is, but I guess they're there. It's part of, you know, it's the Andy Kaufman show. He's doing like a kind of a skit.
He's doing another skit. Wacky Andy Kaufman avant-garde thing.
And I think he senses it, so they do the slap, and then when he comes back and he's just dropping F-bomb after F-bomb, and then he apologises, I'm sorry.
But you, Jerry Lawler, you're a son of a bitch! You're a fucking asshole! You hear me?
Oh God, it's absolutely fantastic. And the crowd is like, they're kind of like, hang on a minute, I'm not really sure.
You can hear that talent. You can almost hear the thought process in the fans, where at first, because they know Kaufman, they're totally with Kaufman, and seeing this as a wacky skit, they're kind of down on Lawler. And Lawler slowly begins to win him over with how witty he is, like the what kind of guy are you line, which I love. Leading to the slap, because Lawler's story is they were going to try and cut to break and do something else, and Lawler just kind of, you know, took it upon himself to slap him in the face. Who knows what's what with this thing. But it's just that thing, and you can hear the audience gasp, because it was such a fucking great slap. If it couldn't have gone better. And then just again, that whole thing of, like, you know, during the break, and there's Kaufman pacing back and forth, like, are you coming back? And he's got, I don't know why, there's something very funny about his face as he's standing there looking miffed, and the crowd's kind of giggling at him, like, this is just such fucking wackiness.
Like, he's performing, and the crowd think he's performing, so the crowd reacts like, you know, the relationship with the performer, and he blanks him. That's the genius of it. He blanks him, and he's just in his own world doing his thing, and they still all the time thinking it's just Kaufman being a great performer, and then it just takes the crowd out of their comfort zone, and it's just absolute genius. It goes on for a year then.
It's not just a one and done.
Yeah, and when he eventually gets the assassins, and they pull the schmars, and they drop Jerry with the pile driver,
and Lawler finally gets to do his
Lawler wrestling promo. It's like, how the hell can the legitimate star Jerry Lawler, you know, do a convincing angry promo on Kaufman, this weedy actor? And like, God, it's fantastic. And he rips off the neck brace and says it'll take a lot more than that. God damn, absolute. Yeah, I guess I never watched it at the time, so I'm not sure the flow of it. It might have petered out, and it's very surreal. Like, the last spot is Jimmy Hart, who, by the way, much love for Jimmy Hart in this
feud. Memphis?
Oh my God, damn. Yeah, he's fantastic.
I had such preconceived notions about Jimmy Hart from the WWF days, and trust me, the more Memphis I've seen, the more I just think, man, this guy is just fucking great.
He's really, really
good. He's really good.
I think the last thing they showed was a newspaper cutting of Kaufman saying he's got cancer.
He's got cancer, yeah.
And like the live audience starts laughing and cheering.
Yeah, they think it's like,
and like so it's like that, and I think that kind of sums this whole feud up in that it was Kaufman and people, it's how hard, everyone would assume it's you know, it's working, it's an angle, and but there was no
nothing.
Yeah, and after all that time there was no sentiment, there was no, oh, you know, it was all an act. It was like, fuck you,
you
yeah,
got it, cancer, you got what you deserve,
yeah, you got what you deserve. Well, yeah, it's just I just love this feud, I just love Kaufman, just yeah, absolute genius.
So moving back into one that's probably a lot more mainstream and a lot more people know, gorgeous Dale Newstead from TPWW Forum say, I'd have to say some of the best work I've seen in a feud is Macho versus Hogan.
Yeah,
it's a very basic story executed to perfection, albeit with a predictable and correct finish. It came at a time where everything, for the most part, that happened meant something. This one is also echoed by the Reverend from the UK fan forum, who says, Hogan versus Savage for me, just a fantastic slow build between two amazing characters, which was so well done.
Hi, have I ever said how great our listeners are with the feedback? Well, just, they've been absolutely nailing it in this podcast. Macho Man Hogan, when I was thinking, like, because we're going to go for our own picks of this as well, I didn't pick this one in the end, but this was one of the three that were in contention for. And the reason why, this was the one that I remember from my childhood. And for any Hogan fans that are out there, you probably might want to skip by 20 minutes as I bury your hero. Because he isn't the good guy in this, okay? Macho Man is. What's great about this feud is, before, and I'm not going to include the Cena and Rock build of recent years, where they spent a year building up to it, because they didn't. It was over a course of a year, but it was basically just a few promos and that was it. This was actually a feud that was built over a year, okay? So we've already mentioned the Hogan-Andre feud, which inevitably went into the tournament at WrestleMania 4, where Macho Man finally wins the title that he so richly deserves. And we then start setting off straight away. As soon as that match was done, they knew what direction they were going in. It was going to be Macho Man-Hogan at WrestleMania 5, same place. And everybody that was involved in it was just perfect. Macho Man obviously was God, not just of wrestling but of life. Hogan was good. Miss Elizabeth played a role, fantastic. Even the commentators, particularly
Jesse's awesome.
Jess is always outstanding, but in this,
this was
his peak. This was his absolute peak. And what made this feud great for me was just the fact, and if you watch, if anyone's bought the new Macho Man DVD, which you should have. And if you haven't, sell your system and buy it, you know, because it's fantastic. And in it, they state, which is common knowledge, is the fact that how intense Macho Man was in real life, particularly around with Miss Elizabeth, and in terms of Hogan as well, and that there was like a genuine mistrust with Randy.
Jealousy.
Yeah, with Randy and Hogan. Whilst, you know, I'm thinking in particular, I'm going to push forwards here towards WrestleMania area, where I'm looking at, I think, a Saturday night main event.
You're thinking of the angle where he actually turns, right?
Yeah, the actual angle where he turns, where, you know, Miss Elizabeth gets knocked out and Hogan takes her to the back and he's looking after her and he's caring for her, maybe grazed a boob. But, you know, and Macho Man goes in the back and is absolutely incensed.
You got jealous eyes!
Yeah, because there was something so real going on in the background, it made what they were doing on screen so much more believable. It was just the element of realism to it. And, you know, we've already gone before about how Miss Elizabeth was an important cog in the Jake the Snake Roberts feud. She was even more important in this because she was the MacGuffin, I guess. Is that a right analogy? From film student, fellow film student,
yeah,
as myself.
I think a MacGuffin is when you don't actually know what the object is. So
I guess, yeah.
Technically.
Yeah, I was trying to think just the object, which everything is centered around. It's a close. It sounded good, but it was wrong. she was the centerpiece to this. And, you know, for a character that didn't actually say much either, she just played it so well.
I'll tell you what, though, we're skipping one great part where at the Royal Rumble, Hogan eliminates Randy Savage, and Savage just gets straight back in the ring and just is fucking livid. Like, what the fuck? Meanwhile, this is the same Hulk Hogan who, like, 3 years later, complains when Sid does the same thing to him. Even Hogan is at the next year with Warrior, he does it the year after that with Tugboat. Hogan's the biggest asshole. Yeah.
Hogan's
that's ever been a top babyface.
Biggest two-faced babyface of all time. He really is. He's such the biggest douche. It's just like, it's the most hidden heel run of all time.
Yeah.
In wrestling. He's an asshole all the time.
797,000 buys for this WrestleMania, but considering the pay-per-view universe at the time is astronomical. Fantastic, massively successful. They did go to the well a little bit. I think it was pretty much dead after Mania 5. I shouldn't say pretty much dead. They came back for SummerSlam with Zeus. Yeah. They did the match on main event with Buster Douglas and stuff like that. So they carried it on, but it was really the 1 year feud, the 1 year building. When the mega powers collide, it was all about that match.
Yeah, I think that's really what stands out over time, and maybe at the time as well. It's just the clear, concise story they told, where they knew where they were going and when they were going to get there, and that afforded you a lot of not wriggle room. Quite the opposite, you can actually plan what the fuck you're going to do.
Yeah. Less TV, less angles too. Yeah, so exactly. Everything got emphasized.
If they were trying to do two angles on two shows a week for a year's time, it can't be done.
Yeah.
It kept it simple on the big shows mainly, and Hogan is a dick, isn't he? He's just a dick.
And I think particularly with that WrestleMania,
you knew from the back rake.
I think the main thing to remember about WrestleMania 5 in particular is that match was really good. It was really good for what it was. I mean, was it Macho Man's best match at Mania?
No.
Was it Hogan's?
No.
Yes.
No, it wasn't.
It was.
It wasn't anywhere near as thrilling as Warrior the next year.
Not even close. In ring it was. In ring work. No. You need to watch that Ultimate Warrior one.
No, I have. I've watched it a lot.
It's good. Don't get me wrong. It's the only good thing.
It's a miracle.
WrestleMania 6, a putrid ass fucking pay-per-view.
Trust me. That match is a miracle. I love Savage. If you ask me who's my favourite wrestler of those three, Savage wins by leaps and bounds. Not even close. But Hogan and Warrior, in terms of pure drama, in terms of the up and down roller coasters we look for, Savage and Hogan didn't have that anywhere near as much as Hogan and Warrior.
You're just a Hogan mark.
All right, we got another one here. Anybody Thriller from TPWW says Bret versus Owen Hart because it was the most realistic feeling feud to me at the time. Also, the matches were awesome and it launched Owen as a fantastic heel. PSF from the UK fan forum also says Bret versus Owen for me. Started off at the Survivor Series 93 and never really ended until their reunion nearly 4 years later. He goes into the details of the feud here, but he mentions, what a great feud. It had a very real feel at the time, to him at least. So this is kind of a bit of a common theme with this feud, kind of touching on reality here. People believing this, which is quite rare for a brother-brother feud in this business.
Well, I was about to say, is this the best sibling rivalry feud of all time?
Easily.
I think so, yeah.
I think maybe what helps it is just Owen is so unlike Bret in so many ways. Yeah. He's just wacky.
So great at being unlikable.
This wacky,
whiny little cunt.
What a whiny dick. That's why I kicked your leg out of your leg. It's a tough one. At the time, I just thought Owen wasn't at Bret's level.
Yeah,
be perfectly honest.
Agreed.
Match wise, yeah, absolutely, there's no doubt about it. And Owen's super talented, but as a feud overall, that's my looking back. That's kind of my impression at the time. Owen wasn't that level.
Well, that's actually what I'm going to say here before I throw it to Chase, because I think this one's different to a lot of the other ones we've compared with. Instead of it being two stars have been built up that are finally colliding, this really was a story. It was Bret's story, and Owen was supplemental to Bret. I think that's what kind of makes this one a very interesting candidate in terms of being a favourite, because Owen was great, don't get me wrong, but Owen Hart was pulled from obscurity when they started this angle. He was doing jobs for Jerry Lawler. He was doing nothing of any kind of real importance until he started the turn. And obviously, the WrestleMania 10 is obviously what's going to be mentioned here in terms of fantastic legendary match. And the scene at the end of the show, which often gets forgotten, is when Bret's being lifted up on the shoulders, and Owen, who beat him at the start of the show, who all along has been saying he's better than Bret, he actually proved it, and people are still parading Bret around on their shoulders, and Owen's just looking at him mouthing, "What about me?" It's fucking brilliant.
Well, what you just stated there is a negative of about, Owen wasn't at the same level as Bret Hart.
I don't say it's a negative, but it's a different dynamic.
Yeah, it's a different dynamic. I state that as it being the positive of that feud. I think the fact that Owen, at least the perception anyway, that Owen wasn't at the same level as Bret was what enhanced the feud, because that's what the feud was about, was that Owen felt that he was always in the shadow of Bret Hart. If you had like two brothers where they were doing that same feud where both are actually just as good as each other and both as popular as each other, but one got jealous, it will work. But when you have something like that where Owen is actually in the shadow of Bret Hart because his career isn't anywhere near as good as Bret, it added realism to what the angle was. So you can actually see why someone like a younger brother like Owen would be jealous of Bret, where Bret's getting everything handed to him, at least it seems. Anyway, he's getting all the title shots and Owen's stuck with Coco Beware. It's like...
I'd be mad about that.
Yeah, and you mentioned with WrestleMania 10, which was a great match as well. For me, which even tops that even higher, was SummerSlam.
I think I prefer Maynard's because I always got a sense that this was this Brett's winning the cage, this is the blow off kind of thing. Whereas WrestleMania 10, great match, and the finish of Owen actually pinning him clean was a lot of what made me go when I watched it for the first time.
That was definitely obviously great and had the surprise factor, and as you said, the bit at the end where he's staring down Brett as well was just, you know, all fantastically done. And I agree, but for me it's the cage match, because one, it's my favourite cage match ever. Which is weird because there's no blood, and there's no there's none of the usual shenanigans that take place in cage matches that time. It was just very clean for a rivalry, and it's quite long as well. It feels quite long, but not necessarily in a bad way. It just feels very dramatic, and like, and they were playing the drama up to the hilt. You know, it's like they're leaping forwards towards the cage door, and it's all very over exaggerated. But like, the crowd are eating it up.
Oh yeah,
the crowd
are there. They're going rabid the whole time.
Yeah, they're absolutely rabid, and it was just so perfectly paced.
But the point I probably didn't articulate myself. It didn't elevate Owen to a degree where I give more stock into the feud as being meaningful.
I see what you mean, in the sense that even though it elevated Owen as a challenger for Brett, it was never a thing where they were equals, where Brett was ultimately, where there was ultimately a chance that he was going to jump to Owen, I guess, for the belt.
What does Owen's just standing in the company? So it was almost, Owen was, you know, great and fun in the role, but did what was he without Brett, kind of thing?
Yeah,
and afterwards.
I probably,
that was never different, I think.
I probably think that was more of a product of what they did with him afterwards. I think if they actually did something with Owen afterwards really significant, then
what could that be?
I'm not Vince McMahon, but it's just like, but if they did something with him, like they really really went off with him with the push and so on, then you'd look back on that Bret Hart feud as it being the beginning of the rise of Owen Hart. But because as soon as that feud finished, he disappeared pretty much and just went into tag team feuds, wasn't it? Was it Yokozuna? Then yeah, when you look back on that feud, it just went like, yeah, he was just there to supplement Bret Hart, give him a feud for a year, because he didn't do anything afterwards. But I think if they tried to do something, even if they just tried to do something different with him, I mean, we've commented before about I think, was it Missed Opportunities, one of the podcasts where he said that Owen Hart would have been a better choice to win the belt than Bob Backlund,
yeah,
and stuff like that. Even however brief than that, that would have been something,
But ultimately, does it get him into a different position than he was anyway? No,
it was always going
to
be,
because look what happened to Backlund.
Yeah, he was always going to have trouble getting into that high position, because obviously couldn't talk that well. But no, but even beyond that, it's like Bret Hart was the golden boy. Shawn Michaels was fluffing Vince McMahon every moment he got, and then Diesel was going to be the new guy. So you had those three guys who were the hierarchy than Owen. So, like, Owen was always going to have difficulty breaking out.
Yeah, but that's the thing.
Three being around. And with Razor Ramon in there as well, but, you know, like, Owen was always going to be lower down.
Yeah, and maybe we're actually just going to agree on the exact same point here. Does Owen Hart really deserve to be above those guys in terms of a top star? Probably not. I mean, say what you will about Nash being a terrible draw.
Yeah.
In Vince's eyes,
Owen's not the first choice of those five.
He was always going to be fed in and out. I think that's the
thing. But I think they could have found room for him.
Yeah, I don't think he wasn't. That's the thing. He wasn't even a legit supplementary character at the top. He was kind of irrelevant. Away from Brett, he was done. As you said, it was Brett's feud. So.
Because I think if they were going to do something with Owen, and this goes the same with Razor Ramon, because we will talk about 95 at length in the future, but you know, Razor Ramon wasn't used to the best of his abilities at the time. And
I don't think 95, Owen, one was.
Yeah, and Owen wasn't either. And I think 95, particularly with how crap the Diesel one was, you know, you had two guys, Owen and Razor Ramon, where, you know, what harm would it have done trying them? Would it have got worse?
Owen,
I don't know.
I don't think Owen should. I don't see there was ever a time where Owen should have been the champion. We're completely veering off the point. I know.
We'll veer right back in a minute, but it's just like, but you know, when Bob Backlund is a better, when they believe Bob Backlund's a better choice over Razor Ramon and Owen Hart.
Yeah, but again, you're looking at this from a perspective of crowning a guy. Backlund wasn't crowned. Backlund was just a guy who they were going to slaughter. And in terms of, like, do they want to slaughter Owen or Razor in 2 days, knowing that, you know, these guys could stick around for a few years and be a big deal for us?
Well, that's
just kind
of weird.
Look what happened to Backlund. He was done as soon as he lost to Diesel.
Well, that's kind of weird, then, because that's given the insinuation, then, that they actually had stock in Razor, Ramon, and Owen.
They did.
But they didn't use them well.
They didn't use anyone well. Even the guys who did have stock.
Can't say, like, oh, we're not going to bury these two guys and then not do anything with them the following year.
They didn't bury him, but at the same time, what they thought they were doing was good, but it clearly wasn't. Look at Bret Hart was doing in 1995, for Christ's sake. He was doing absolutely nothing of importance, and that's Bret Hart. Yeah. with all that built with yeah. all that built up fucking reputation mm. and however he was in, yeah. in Europe and Canada and stuff. If he's getting fucking Jean-Pierre Lafitte, nothing against the yeah. pirate. But yeah. Owen, what's Owen Hart's yeah. prayer? You know,
I just think I don't think Owen Hart would have been, you know, the biggest name of all time. But I think there was an opportunity, and looking at all the people they've tried to push in the past, right? I think that Owen deserved a chance beyond the Bret Hart feud. Just my personal opinion. I think of all the people they pushed, that ended up being shit and didn't have half the talent Owen Hart had.
Yeah, but it's time.
I think Owen, you know. I think Owen was a more deserving person than a lot of those people.
Oh, I'd say he's more deserving against time and place. And hey, he got a run that a lot of people didn't get.
Yeah, that's not take away from the actual run. It was a great run.
Well, yeah, it's been mentioned now. Exactly. In the podcast years
it's
later.
It's being mentioned as an all-time favourite feud. Look at that lovely fucking steering it back on track.
Yeah, good work.
But again, it's all-time personal favourite with ranking here.
That, truly.
And for somebody else's all-time personal favourite, King Pitcos from the UK Fan Forum, I'll go with The Rock versus Mankind. I was 15, so I was in full hate the top face who was overpushed and repetitive and buries everyone mode, and this feud only had Austin doing cameos. Rock and Mankind were my two favourite wrestlers, both at the top of their game as characters, and they absolutely killed it for those months. I think both of them had something to prove, competing to get out from under Stone Cold Shadow, even if it was all just building to LOL Austin wins at WrestleMania.
I'll pick out the negative straight away of that feud, and that was the constant title changes, which just in that early period on the build to WrestleMania 15 wasn't the best way to build your champion going in against Austin.
I disagree, respectfully, because as much
there was quite a few title changes at that time.
There were title changes, but both of them came out stronger for it. If Rock just smoked Foley, then he's just a stopgap challenger. So, yeah. Whereas Foley was, I mean, when Foley wins the belt, that is one of my favourite moments in the history of Raw. Even if it is an Austin cameo that causes it, the fans just go fucking ballistic. Oh, yeah. Foley was made by winning the belt. Rock was made by beating him back.
Yeah.
And by going back and forth one more time each, it made it that kind of... Again, it wasn't just one man's feud. It was a two-man thing. Both sides gained from it. And the title changes, they weren't essential, but they took nothing away.
Yeah, okay. As I've already stated before, when I was talking about, you know, feuds that Rock have had that are better than Austin, and also about people who are polar opposites that work so well together, you can't get much polar opposite than, you know, the charismatic, good-looking, you know, like pedigree of the Rock with and I love Mick. This weird, overweight, missing an ear, missing several teeth,
freak.
Burns, this freak of nature. Now, when you watch this back, this feud back, and the certain elements, and I'm going to pick on Royal Rumble in particular, it is hard to watch by modern standards.
Oh, the chair shots?
The chair shots in particular, yeah. For me, watching back that Royal Rumble in particular, I'm going to highlight over everything. I know they did plenty, as you said, that not-so-good Rock Bottom show, or the Survivor Series 98, where they redid the screw job and so on, and also the halftime empty arena.
Halftime heat.
And so on. A lot of great moments. But for me, it was the Royal Rumble. And I always just love the moment where he's standing over Mick after he's just gone through the electrical boards or whatever, and like Shane McMahon's come out, and he's just like, yeah, just like... He's gone, man. Just leave him. He's just done now. Like, the match is over. And he just goes, no.
Yeah.
I will pin this on a bitch. I'll be damned if I don't.
And I was just like...
Weird one. At the time, I was just a massive Rock mark. I think as soon as he started talking about himself in the third person, I never wanted Foley to win as, like, that kind of a fan. But just, goddamn, yeah, two guys who were just, again, really good. You can see guys who were just... get what they're doing. It's like so damn talented. Foley, the Rumble chair shots thing, don't tell me Foley didn't okay that. I don't care if he tells his wife that afterwards. I'm not buying that, Mick. You knew what was going on.
Yeah. He claims it's supposed to be five and Rock just got excited.
Yeah, excited.
Mick should have gone to the back quicker, because obviously Rock was thinking, you know, you're going to move, sir.
Yeah, he definitely could have shrugged away, and he could have run away or just shout, stop hitting me. You know, he could have done a lot of things to stop Rock from actually hitting him with a chair.
Yeah, I think
but it is obviously knowing what we know about chair shots and concussions and so on, and he did have a concussion, I believe.
If he didn't have a concussion, I'd be fucking stunned.
It's just but watching that back now and just knowing obviously what we know, it's just like, oh god,
it wasn't a good idea.
But at the time of watching it, because I was a kid and an asshole, I just loved every moment of it. I was like, hit him again. I didn't realize I was stupid.
Yeah,
I think although I'll say I wasn't, you know, on in any way enamoured with wanting Foley to win, you know, really love Foley individually, but I think this is one of the three amazing jobs Foley did, the most underrated man of that attitude in terms of making Austin,
making
Triple H, making Rock. He was the supplementary star maker in many ways. Mm. When guys, obviously, when Austin got the belt, then he had no one to challenge. And the first week, it's Dude Love comes out and it's like, what the fuck is this? Yeah. Who cares? And it's just magic, and which I guess, you know, says its own story. But the importance in that company at that time, he was so important.
Yeah, he was key. He was absolutely key. Brazil from F4W says, Rock, Mankind has to be up there. Rock was just getting real hot in the fall of 98 as a babyface. Mankind was still heel, but gained so much sympathy after the King of the Ring, his 2-1-1 loss to the Outlaws at SummerSlam, and his effort in the three-way cage the month after at Breakdown. Oh,
that's when people started cheering the Rock like I did.
Yeah, the double people's elbow. And being a not-so-happy corporate stooge, Mr. Socko also took off around this time, so they did the double turn at Survivor Series, and off to the races they went. Rock really got over as a badass with what Foley would let him do, and Foley got over being awesome with The Rock, who was just on fire. Just to finish off King Pitcoss's comments too, because I like this. Two-stroke Rock is probably my favourite Rock.
Yeah.
Boob surgery Rock.
Yeah, boob surgery Rock. Moving on to another feud featuring the great one. Dr. Peter Venkman from the UK fan forum. Mine's Rock. Name. Triple H in 2000. Even though they only had the 2-1-on-1 pay-per-view matches, the feud had sort of built up since 98, so it had all the backstory. The Backlash and Judgment Day matches are in many ways definitive Attitude Era pay-per-view main events for me, and they were the two biggest stars in what's probably WWE's greatest ever calendar year. Just a shame they didn't have a proper blow-off at Hell in a Cell at Fully Loaded or SummerSlam that year.
This was another one that I was in contention for me, because getting, as I said, back into wrestling after watching all the stuff that Rock had previously done, then heading into Royal Rumble, it was the Rock Triple H feud that sold WWF over WCW for me. Not that it needed the much selling at that point.
Say fuck.
You know, it's like night and day.
You had Sid in the main event.
Yeah, don't remind me. Just the intensity of it. I mean, we've already gone into briefly like 98 feud with the ladder match and so on, which I love, fantastic.
Oh.
But yeah,
it slams him on the ladder and looks.
Yeah. I mean, I've already gone into that match, so I'll let you guys talk about it if you want. But it's in 2000 with those two, I just saw them as very kind of equals in the ring. Rock was in his prime. Triple H had just hit his prime in 2000, and it was just like you're just watching two guys just absolutely go at it in various different ones. He said there was only two singles matches, but like you barely noticed that. If they inserted other people in there, that was fine, but the two people you were watching were Rock and Triple H.
I disagree. That I was bitterly disappointed. Sounding quite negative on the show, I think. Don't mean to.
Don't worry, the Kaufman stuff carries your
weight. Ah, thanks. Yeah. The four-way at Mania.
I hate that. I guess it's probably going to echo what you're going to say. It just felt like you never really truly got what you wanted out of it, with the exception of Backlash, when Rock finally wins, when Austin comes back and kills everybody, and Rock finally gets him one-on-one. Rock wins, crowd goes wild, babies are thrown in the air, and then 1 month later, Triple H gets it fucking back.
Yeah. That's the thing I was going to say. What I was leaning to is, it's a solid story. Kind of petered out. He never got the culminating moment. And jeez, how can you not? It was Rock during his hottest period. And you don't give him a proper payoff.
He beat Vince at King of the Ring to get belt Triple H.
I think I said in the 2000 podcast that because I picked out Backlash as being a highlight, that for me Backlash was the real WrestleMania that year. And because
it's the show that Mania should have been.
It's what the show should have been. Yeah, because you know it's a lot more kind of condensed. You know, it's more one-on-one matches as opposed to, because there was only one one-on-one match at WrestleMania 2000. I don't like the four-way. Obviously, I don't like the four-way because the McMahons were involved.
Yeah,
which is obviously we weren't going to avoid in 2000. That was always going to be inevitability.
It didn't have to be though.
Now you got a Rock. Triple H, as you said.
But for the minds of the McMahons, it was always going to be an inevitability that they get involved.
Yeah, I know.
It just
pisses us off, that's all.
Don't worry, it pissed me off more than anyone else, because I wanted to see Rock Triple H.
I think
there was pitfalls. There were pitfalls in that feud, and that certainly is one of them. But as a whole, because whilst they had one-on-one, only two one-on-one matches, I remember there being, it wasn't just the pay-per-view matches that they had, you know, because there was a lot of distractions, you know, the Benoit match and the Kurt Angle being involved as well, and the six-man tag at King of the Ring and so on. A lot of people being inserted into that feud. But watching Raw and SmackDown every week, those two guys were just always facing off against one each other. Yeah, they threw so many people in there. I mean, they threw in Jericho in there, Benoit, the Radicals, the Hardys, Dudleys, Edge and Christian, anyone into that feud. And it didn't matter. It was just like the focus was Triple H and Rock. Those guys went for it until Austin came back.
Well, I like that the first part of the feud was always, it kind of makes me laugh, because to me, Triple H was so irrelevant in that feud. It was all about The Rock. It was, you know, the promo on the ladder with before the ladder match itself.
SummerSlam 98 you're talking about.
Yeah. So the first part of the...
Oh my God. Yeah. He was so irrelevant in 98.
Yeah, it was. I mean, Triple H at the time, you know, I didn't care about The Nation, I loved The Rock. No, D-Lo was coming
through.
D-Lo. D-Lo love. Triple H was like the most boring, uncool member of DX at the time.
Oh. And that includes Billy Gunn. So what was that?
Yeah. So it's, you know, you got Rock on his ladder doing the some get China on her knees, a natural position for you. It's all just be the most entertaining man in the world. And then you get the match at SummerSlam, and when he drops him on the ladder, and New York agrees, and I'm going to shoot by Triple H, and just erupts when Rocky just pulls himself up for that people's elbow.
He did, however, explode when Triple H wins.
They did it. They did
give him. So not just act like he was just in the ring.
No. Right. I mean, the DX obviously were over. Predominantly his face. There's no two ways about it. But in the feud, Triple H was kind of dwarfed by Rock's charisma.
Absolutely.
So it's quite amusing. I think what's kind of like the underlying thing, which may or may not have been there for some people, is the actual natural rivalry between the two of them. Rock is the chosen one for a couple of years, and obviously Triple H had ideas of his own, and it was that element as well. The fact that Rock actually survived and thrived and became who he was with that aura of Triple H probably looking to
sabotage him every turn in many ways.
It's just a miracle that he actually became what he was, probably.
We've got another one here for this. Air Jordan fan 93 from F4W says, Triple H and Rock, these guys mirrored each other for years, and when they were in fairly poor gimmicks at the early stages of the Attitude Era in 97, feuding for the IC title, then leading DX and The Nation respectively in 98, and both being seen as the next two main event level guys, and culminating in a great ladder match at SummerSlam 98. Then onto, actually, you know what, DX and Nation was a great mid-card feud in 98
It was. It carried the mid-card.
Did. And lastly onto 2000 with a great back and forth for the title in the spring, including the best Iron Man match the WWE has ever done. Pretty interesting to note, though, that by the time the Iron Man came around, I think they kind of cooked the goose on this a little bit, because the Chris Benoit Rock match from Fully Loaded actually did a better buy rate than Rock Triple H Iron Man.
The Rock is stated in 98. Yeah, he was far head and shoulders. As I said, it was the performance that made him stand out for me, that made me just love him so much. You know, it's just like this is the guy, and Triple H is the douche. You know, and as you said, like, this is the group that consists of Billy Gunn. I also state this is the group that has a guy that split his asshole open twice. And yet still, Triple H is the biggest douche in the group, okay? So it's just
Pack and dog with the cool ones in DX, I'm telling you.
Well, it was a long time ago for Pac.
Moving along, Chrissy from Pro Wrestling Only, Ric Flair versus Terry Funk is pretty much at the top of my list because it kickstarted the awesome year of NWA and gave Flair the rebirth he sorely needed. Everything around that feud was awesome, with the promotion benefiting as well. Ron Sheik from F4W mentions the same one. Logical beginning, with Funk feeling slighted by Flair implying I'm not good enough, and goes off. Awesome interviews, awesome matches, great blow-off, and it ended in a handshake.
Yes!
Another awesome candidate. I adore Terry Funk, and this is just fucking brilliant. The Russell War angle, goes nuts, pile drives him on the table. It's actually funny because we actually talked about the two matches, if I'm not mistaken, about two podcasts ago.
So we mentioned a lot recently.
Yeah, we have mentioned Funk and Flair quite a bit, but I don't want to completely ignore this, because what a glorious feud.
This is my number one.
Really?
This is my number one. Yeah, this is the one that when we were talking about which one we were going to pick initially, that we were going to talk about, this was my number one. But yeah, 89, the best year of Ric Flair ever. We've already, he's had the feud with Steamboat already. This Funk feud is just phenomenal. I was watching everything I had on this feud the other day when we were originally going to do this podcast, right? And just as I was watching it, Funk's fantastic as the heel, right? It's just a thing of, you have Dumb and Dumber where you got Mad and Madder in this one. You know, Flair's mad and just Funk is just madder in this one. He's
batshit.
He's just batshit crazy, and he's beautiful as well. He's beautiful in every way. And Flair, but I'm going to specifically talk about the Great American Bash, okay? This first match.
I'm afraid, because I think this might have been discussed on two separate podcasts already.
I know.
But the post-match brawl. We know that Jason... Yeah, you can go back and listen, because this is detailed in two separate podcasts, but just go and watch.
Kill it again.
But just the fucking crazy brawl at the end. The great promo, and it all leads to the I Quit match, like we said.
Yeah.
And just an awesome, including one of my favourite spots of all time, when Flair throws Funk over the table and he hits his face on a chair on the way down.
That's great. I just watched that over and over again. It's so brilliant. That entire feud from beginning to end, where it's just the brawl, which for me is the highlight, the brawl after the Great American Bash is just
just best, how it just keeps going. It's like 10 minutes long at least.
Oh yeah.
And just Flair just cuts, for me, one of his best promos ever. Wow, how the fuck was he not turned babyface before now?
It's like,
because he was just a heel for so long. Yeah,
people wanted it. That's the thing.
Heel for so long.
Man, Dusty in 88 was not. I mean, he was being booed when he won the Bunkhouse Stampede. People were not wanting Dusty on top, and Flair was the. That was the answer. It was Flair was a babyface.
It was so obvious watching that promo that this guy wasn't just, you know, the one trick pony. Not saying that he ever was, but like, he wasn't the one trick pony, as he could only be a heel. He could be a great babyface as well, and he was fantastic. You know, having Sting there as well also helped, because Sting was very popular at the time as well. And it's just going into that, like, the I Quit as well, and, you know, Funk saying that he, you know, if you beat me, I'll shake your hand. I think I prefer the Great American Bash one over the I Quit, but that's not to say that the I Quit is weak in any way.
No one would.
A weird match. There's plenty of other ones that during my childhood and my early years watching wrestling again were more influential, but now, as a 30-year-old guy watching wrestling now, going back, this is the highlight feud for me, because this was perfect from beginning to end.
And then what more to add, really? Flair is a genius. Funk definitely is a special kind of genius, and it was a beautiful feud, so yeah.
It's simple as that. Just one final point to add on the turn. What fucking beautiful punches from Terry Funk.
Oh, God,
you never see CM Punk though punch like that.
Funk can't do a lot wrong in my mind. I really love Terry Funk. In some similar ways to my Kaufman love, actually. He's got like,
Bad News Gertner from TPWW says, Tommy Dreamer versus Raven in ECW. Tommy was such a great sympathetic baby face. Oh, Kieran, calm down. And Raven was such a tremendous heel that week after week, I wonder, will this be the day that Dreamer wins? He just made you want to pull for him so bad. This is a personal opinion in terms of all-time favourite feuds. I know that Kieran, you have very strong feelings towards Tom Dreamer. I do love Raven.
Just talk about Raven.
To be fair, I think last time I ranted incoherently without rhyme or reason of my random hatred for Tommy Dreamer. That still stands, but I like the feud.
Yeah.
I liked, again, you know, just clear, concise, the direction, escalating. It's a good feud. And, yeah,
introducing so many other characters and getting spread away. Helping other people. The Cactus Jack turn comes from this.
It was a well done, well told story. So as a feud, I liked it. I just hate Tommy Dreamer.
So you weren't feeling the whole sympathetic babyface thing, but at the same time, a great bit by bit story of that whole the summer camp thing. It's funny how a feud that was so kind of, I would say preposterous, but the whole summer camp.
Contrived.
Very soap opera, wasn't it?
And it got over so well to ECW fans. It's quite an interesting little dynamic there. But Raven, I think to me, Raven's the star, and Raven's the reason why.
Of course.
Raven's the reason why this works so well for me. He was just such a fucking.
Yeah.
I love the guy at this period of time. But the character was such an asshole. It kind of bled over to the Sandman feud too, where he was just
off the back of the Sandman.
Raven's got lower and lower. And again, talk about that Jake Roberts. This guy will commit some sleazy acts.
Yeah.
Raven certainly fits that category too.
Well, yeah, but that's just him in real life. Fresh original character. I think maybe that's why people were a bit more forgiving with the feud itself, is because Raven was so fresh and different himself to the guys at that time, and maybe just that ECW creative, because it was theirs as well, so they were always going to be a bit more giving towards it. And it was just a really well thought out feud.
So many great little moments, the chair shot heard around the world, all these little bullet points we could get into, but just a lot of nice moments.
In terms of a well structured story and feud, it was really good. So I'm not going to take away from it.
Soup23 from Pro Wrestling Only. I thought about this for a while, and I think one of the things that can detract a great feud ever so slightly is not having the climax be at a satisfying point in time. Misawa versus Kobashi and Misawa versus Kawada have this problem in my opinion. That is why Jumbo Tsuruta versus Genichiro Tenryu is my pick. It would have been very easy for the October 88 to be the time for Jumbo to drop the fall to Tenryu, but they pushed one more time and made June 5th, 1989 that much more beautiful. That is why this is my pick.
Yeah, it's nice seeing this. I was thinking just in terms of the particularly what watching and thinking about Kobashi and Misawa as well, I'm kind of thinking a similar thing. It was, I love their series of matches, but similar to Rock Austin, Kobashi was his bitch for so long. Whether you factor that in or not, it's complete personal preference. I watched this the second match at least. It was a really fun match. They beat the shit out of each other, not as crisp as I was expecting going in. I mean, I was watching this with complete fresh eyes. The one thing that stands out, I've always thought about Japanese wrestling, is the ability to tell a story in ring. And without understanding the announcers or and just much of a knowledge of the backstory, how a story is told, a narrative is told through the actual wrestling action, which sounds preposterously stupid and basic.
It sounds so 101.
Yeah, it sounds so basic, like all Russians should be like that, but it slaps you in the face when and the story when it comes to the title matches and the culmination of the title matches is something that all Japan seem to do well over and over again, really, as Kawada and Misawa as well.
That series is awesome. Yeah. That's a very high candidate for me. Yeah. Just to go to his point, though, because the thing about Misawa Kawada is that the feud not having the right culmination at the right moment. Kawada and Misawa feuded for like 5 years before Kawada ever pinned him in a singles match. It took him 2.5 years to even pin him at all in a tag. It's like that constant, and the whole point of the feud was Kawada pushing. All Japan's booking was so notoriously slow under Barber that like these things they would run with them forever. And then you know, we got a lot of great matches consequently, but the Misawa Kawada feud, man, again, just so many great matches. The June 3rd, 1994 match, I think I've mentioned before, the just a fantastic match with the deadly Tiger Driver at the end from Misawa. Just a fucking classic match, one of my favourite matches of all time. That's a candidate for me. Jumbo and Tenryu's a really interesting one, just because I love those two matches in it, because I mean, they've been feuding since like the middle of 87. So what we're talking about here is the two matches for the Triple Crown, after the Triple Crown had been formed in 1989. The first one was more of a supplementary kind of setup match to the second one, which is a fucking great match. I love that. Yeah, again, so fucking physical. Not as smooth as you might expect.
But I think that, it kind of helps it in a way.
Yeah, it totally does, because the energy feels more. And yeah. The crowd seems to pick up on that too.
Yeah.
So
Japanese stuff... I've watched more historical stuff than like contemporary, say, New Japan, like you guys have. But it's the, I think maybe with Japanese, whether it be film as well, we talk about like Akira Kurosawa's films or anime or something, the Japanese have an ability to almost like create a believable mythology, like in anything is believable within the set world that you know you're given, kind of thing. And it's, I don't know, it's very it's something that always stands out to me. And in terms of Japanese wrestling, that's what I really love, is just the true sport and emotion, the legitimacy they can give to like this fake sport is it's like a lost art. And yeah, Japan does it like.
Just that point about emotion, man, is the crowd fucking rabid in that second match.
When he hits him, was it a side suplex? I can't remember what his move was, where in the pinfall, and it's a two count.
Oh yeah.
Right at the finish, and it's like the crowd like screams,
they're pissing their pants.
Screams like there's been a murder, and there's just like, oh, it's unbelievable. And then finally he hits it again, like straight after, because whether it was a fuck up or what, but it was like so dramatic. Yeah, it's fantastic.
When you watch it, you know, today's product with New Japan, they're just a lot more willing to go with it, rather than the American or the British audience, where we're just trying to be so smart, we're trying to read up on everything and know everything about everyone. The Japanese just seem to be a whole lot more like, hey, I'm sat here, paid my ticket, entertain me. I've got no preconceived conceptions about this.
It still comes back to how you present your product, though, don't you? And that's the kind of clientele you attract.
Seth from TPWW mentioned Sting versus the NWO. That whole feud leading up to him joining and then subsequent swerves. Man, I miss those days. Petey from Pro Wrestling Only says, I'm 27, so my first-hand experience is pretty much limited to the WWF and WCW, but I was all in with Sting versus Hogan and the NWO. The fact that both league guys weren't on every Nitro made their appearances all the more special. Yes, it started to drag, especially as WCW was spinning its wheels in the fall of 1997. But I was so amped for the inevitable match, and yeah, the payoff sucked, but the build was tremendous.
I believe we talked about this a little bit on a recent trial, didn't we?
We did indeed. And we gave kudos to Mr. Bischoff for holding off.
We gave kudos for holding off, and then
buried him for the product at the end.
Well, that wasn't Bischoff's fault.
No, it wasn't.
It was.
the payoff really, really sours me on this.
It sucked.
Yeah.
It sucked. There's never been a more disappointing blow off pay per view than Starrcade 97.
Well, yeah, I mean, also just the main point, obviously, concluding from Starrcade, you know, we were talking about the Bret Hart Owen. We were talking about, you know, what did that feud actually do for Hart, Owen Hart in the end? It's like, yeah, what did that feud do for Sting in the end?
They sucked all the shine off him with the finish.
Yeah, yeah. That's the thing.
Awesome build. And obviously, Sting is extremely topical at the moment because of the Survivor Series. And actually, in my mind, obviously the word came out on Saturday, Sting's been signed, he's probably going to be there. And I watched Uncensored 97, the final scene from that show where Sting comes from the rafters to lay out the NWO for the first time with a baseball bat, and he finally gets to Hogan and just lays him out with the Scorpion Death Drop. And it's like, if they do this at the Survivor Series, my God, isn't that going to be awesome?
He was never coming from the ceiling.
No, not only was he not coming from the ceiling, for obvious reasons, but they didn't even give him the whole thing of just slaughtering the world and just looking like it. And it was fucking so good. Because the whole thing of, as contrived as the fake Sting element of the NWO was, and as initially not popular as it was with the audience that watched on TV, and about a quarter of people turned off when it happened, long term, as a mechanism to get Sting into a new dimension, it was brilliant, and they played it so slowly, but it was so well done. They just left the question there for months, what's going on with Sting? Yeah. In total, it was probably about 7 months before it was obvious he's WCW's guy, he's fighting the NWO. 7 months before they even paint him in which corner he's in, and then they wait another 7 months to do the match. And it's like, like the feedback said there, it did drag towards the fall of 97 when they went to Hogan Piper part 15. But man, it was just, you wanted that match so bad. Yeah. They took Sting, who before was clearly number two or three behind Hogan and Savage, and they just let you just want him and want that match. And they did such a good job, and that's why it's so tragic that they just fucked it up so bad.
So bad. I mean, it was, Sting was the guy kind of, I know he was lost in time, coming off the Surfer Dude gimmick. And I don't know, to take that and then to turn him into this really cool gimmick.
Yeah.
I was like, I just, that finish. I'm talking about, the importance of a narrative. For me, that's it. When you fuck the finish like that, you kill the whole story. And it's, whether it's Alexa expressing or it's James Storm in TNA, it's, if you build something like that and then you fuck it and you don't pay it off, that's more damaging than shit booking most of the time, I think. Because people remember the shit. So.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Loki from UK Fan Forum. The first one that pops into my mind is Kurt Angle versus Chris Benoit, which went over a number of years, but mainly during the SmackDown 6 / Paul Heyman era of SmackDown. They pretty much started in 2000. The first big match, I think, was that steel cage match on Raw, that was 2001, where Angle did the moonsault off the top of the cage and Benoit did 10 German suplexes. Then they had the long series of amazing pay-per-view matches, as good a set of wrestling matches as you'll ever see. The triple threat match at WrestleMania 16, the 30-minute submission match at Backlash, 3 stages of Hell at Judgment Day, and the great Royal Rumble 2003 match.
That's the one.
Yeah.
It totally is. The first real one actually was WrestleMania 17, which I actually think is very, very underrated. Well, people love that match. I can't say it's underrated.
It's when they start for the amateur stuff.
They start for the amateur. It was the first time they'd done the amateur stuff, which it was amazing to watch. This is like something out of Japan. You never see something like this in the WWE, and the crowd was buying it. It's like, this is something different. The following matches I didn't really like all that much. The Backlash and Judgment Day ones never really hit the mark.
Can't even remember them, to be perfect.
Exactly.
Yeah, the Rumble match, I thought. Was
the Rumble match is fantastic. Yeah. The Kurt Angle, Chris Benoit tag team era on SmackDown. With them as reluctant partners.
They wrestled each other before they did the tag team feud. They wrestled each other at Unforgiven, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's a good match.
Which is the period that he describes that whole time where they were on SmackDown, which for me accumulated at Royal Rumble, which was just masterclass in wrestling.
The reason it's my favourite feud, he says, is because it was such a simple one. They didn't like each other and each thought themselves superior to the other. Add to that, they told most of the story in the ring through mannerisms and spots and some cracking pull-aparts. For a guy as weak at promos as Benoit, it totally played to his strengths. Two guys in their prime doing their best work. I'm a sucker for the technical wrestling but end up doing big moves type match, so this feud really hit the spot with me.
Tough one. I mean, you think you're really looking at it as a purely in-ring predominantly
series.
Yeah. And so, on that respect, so how many are you looking at? Four, something like that? Four, five? Two, one very good, one excellent, a couple of disappointing. So I say it's a tough one, maybe. The best they did together was absolutely fantastic. And yeah, I said that Rumble match, I absolutely love that match. Being only an in-ring feud, maybe it needed another stellar match to be,
We want more.
I want more. God damn it, more.
That was so damn good. We want more. Yeah. All right. So to conclude this, and thank you very much for all the feedback. If we didn't get to it this time, I apologise. But we had an immense amount of candidates. Obviously, there were ones that we couldn't get to, like Austin McMahon's on the list. There were so many that I couldn't get to through time.
Foley Orton.
There's so many. I deeply apologize. Freebirds Von Erichs that got mentioned a lot.
Freebirds Von Erichs. Yeah.
Oh my god. So anyway. This will be the final time since we have to wrap it up here for time. Around the table, What is your all-time favourite feud and why?
I'm just getting a smile. I'm just getting warmed up.
Funk and Flair.
Wear your ass out.
Funk and Flair for you.
Damn right.
Funk and Flair for G. Kieran, I'm putting you on the spot here.
This is a tough one, and I might not even believe this to be true off the top of my head. Can someone else go first?
Right, I'll tell you what, I'll cut in here with a different one, because mine... One, and it's interesting, we mentioned at the start of this podcast we're looking for commonalities, certain themes that come through, and I think a lot of what came through in the feedback, even though it wasn't necessarily directly said, is ones that at that perfect point of their wrestling fandom was the right thing that hit at the right time. When I got into wrestling, the big feud was Bret Hart and Jerry Lawler. I love that feud because so Jerry good. Lawler is fantastic in that feud.
He's such an
asshole. SummerSlam 93 is one of my all-time Brilliant. Favorite performances from a heel. Because Jerry Lawler coming out on the crutches, doing that promo, talking about how he got in a car wreck, saving orphans. Saving the orphans from a burning bus, as Bobby Heenan added. Only to hit him with a crutch, be a complete asswipe, and then get the heat on Bret again when they do wrestle, lose to such a completely climactic degree, and somehow still win to the point where when everybody, the whole family, is trying to beat up Lawler after his awesome, first of all, the great King of the Ring angle, the awesome stuff on Raw where he's burying the family, and then finally at SummerSlam, the whole family gets him back, they beat him up, but he actually won, and as they're wheeling away on the stretcher, running to the back because it's urgent, he raises a single finger in the air, like he actually did something himself, which actually The Rock would go on to do a few years later with Ken Shamrock with the IC belt, but it's a fantastic little bit. I love that match so much. I love that. And it's a shame, though, again, and that was the peak of the feud because the Survivor Series blow-off never happened. But as a fan growing up, that was the one that I always... Yeah. I watched that summer. So I wore that tape out because that was one of the first ones I got. Overall, I'm not sure if I put it as my favourite now, but that's the first one that comes to mind for probably the same reason a lot of these candidates did.
Mm. Yeah, I can't really think of... There's nothing. I don't have
it's
one.
It's really hard.
I don't. I really don't have one that stands out like that. It just. I think we've all kind of thought that coming of this, thinking of this topic the last 2 weeks. Really, it's
difficult.
I'm gonna have to go with Crush versus Doink.
can we just all agree though that the MVP of this podcast has been Macho Man Randy Savage, who's got the most
actually
nominations.
No, Rock equals him.
Oh yeah, my number one and number two guy.
Well, there you go.
What can I say?
There you go.
Yes!
I don't know if you win anything for that, do you?
I don't know. I win my own respect.
Well, you don't have mine, so...
And on that fantastic note, I want to thank everybody for listening. Again, thank you for the feedback. We will be back next week. Hopefully, there'll be no M1 catastrophes this time. So, for Kieran O'Rourke...
Riverdurchy.
For G. John Chase...
Heart, stars and horseshoes, clovers and blue moons... Hourglass and rainbows and tasty red balloons.
I'm Liam O'Rourke and we are out of here.